Hey, good evening. Good to be with you guys. You know, so if you weren't here for the demo, first of all, you missed it. But there was a question that was asked of James. And the question was, would you rather fight 100 duck-sized horses or fight one horse-sized duck? And I've thought about this a lot in the last 17 minutes. You got to go with the horse. You got like the horse-sized duck. Because like there are lots of guys who have beaten up other big guys that are bigger than them. But you don't know anybody that's fought 100 people and won. But more than that, like there's different ways to frame that question. So one of those ways to frame the question is, what do you think you're going to be the most effective doing? AKA, what do you think you could survive? The other way to ask the question is, what's the smartest thing that you could do in the situation? And that would be to run and fight neither. But the reason I bring that up is what you're processing when you're thinking about that question is you're thinking about courage. What do you have the fortitude to do? What do you have the willingness to step into? And I think oftentimes, particularly in male Western culture, the way that we shape courage is this ability to withstand the most difficult, dangerous, largest endeavor in the world. And so if I wanted to give you a picture of courage that the media would give us, I love movies, and in particular, I love the Marvel movies. I love superhero movies. And so there's the movie Avengers Endgame. And so this is a trigger warning. I'm going to ruin the end for you, and that's not on me, because that movie's been out for long enough that if you hadn't seen it, you didn't intend to see it, so that's not my fault. And so if you don't know what happens at the end of Infinity War, Thanos snaps and half the universe disappears and nobody knows why. And so they figure out a plan at the start of Endgame to go back in time, get all the stones together, snap again, and have everybody come back. And so they make that happen, and they're not sure if it even works. And Thanos shows up and decides that he's going to wreak havoc. And he says, hey, I messed up because last time I got rid of half of y'all, I'm going to get rid of all of y'all this time. And so at that moment, you've got Thor, and you've got Iron Man, and you've got Captain America, Steve Rogers, and they're fighting him, and they keep going through these scenes of everything they try to do doesn't work, and at some point, Thor's kind of laid out, Iron Man's laid out, and Captain America, his shield has been broken to like a third of what was left of the normal shield, and there's this moment where he gets up, and he picks up the fragment of the shield, and he takes the two leather straps, and it just shows his forearm, and he pulls the strap tight as if to say, I'm willing to die on this thing because I'm not giving up in this battle. And every single one of us, as we watched that scene, there was like a hair that popped up on our chest, and we felt a little bit more like, yeah, Steve Rogers, yeah, I want to have that type of courage. Except for I often don't think that's what the scriptures would call us to. Or maybe the way that you would think that I would do this, if the theme is going to be courage, is that I would open up the Old Testament, and I would go find that story of David and Goliath. And Saul, though he is the king, and he is head and shoulders taller than everybody else, and so therefore seems to be the most applicable person to go against the Philistine giant. You put your center against the other team's center, like that's what you're supposed to do. But he's sitting back and telling David, you should put on my armor, and David's not willing to put on his armor, but instead David goes to the brook and finds five smooth stones. And is frustrated that this Philistine blasphemer would speak against his God, and so encouraged, he steps up. But here's the reality that you're not David, Jesus actually is, and so that's not the most accurate story of courage either. And so what does biblical courage look like? I think it's actually smaller and more subtle than often what we would like to think that it is. So here's what I'd love to do. I'd like to take some time and jump into John chapter 6 with you. I feel bad because I know that you guys are waiting to eat some ribeye, and I'm going to tell you a story about food in the scriptures. That feels unfair. But I want to spend some time telling the story of the feeding of the 5,000, and I actually want to show you a picture of biblical courage from that narrative. So here's what we'll do. In verses 1 through 4, we're just going to look at the setting. In verses 5 through 9, we're going to look at an impossible challenge. In verses 9 through 11, we're going to see this picture of not much to work with. And then in verses 11 through 15, we're going to see this reality of being full but not fulfilled. So if you will you pray with me one more time as we jump in? So Father, thank you. There was this refrain in Christ Our Wisdom that we just sang a few moments ago, that you are God and we are not. And that may be the most honest, courageous thing we could say tonight. Far too often, whether it is our own self-conception or whether it's the pressure of the world, we try and exalt ourselves, or we're forced to exalt ourselves into a place of all power and all knowledge and all ability, and the reality is that we are not, you are. And so, Lord, I even confess that regardless of what I prepared, regardless of what I studied, regardless of what I thought through, you are God, I am not, that the hearts of the men in this room will only be impacted by what you do, not by what I say. So I trust you for that, but I courageously offer what little I have, believing that you're going to work with it. It's in your matchless name I pray. Amen? Here's the idea that I want to drive our thinking tonight. Our faith in Jesus gives us eyes to see opportunities and challenging amid challenging obstacles. Therefore, the people of God respond to chaos with courage. John chapter 6 is famous in so many different ways, but in particular because of the narrative of the feeding of the 5,000. In fact, it's one of the few narratives that all four Gospels share. And so John in his Gospel would tell the story this way. After this, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias. A large crowd was following him because they saw the signs that he was doing on the sick. Jesus went up on the mountain, and there he sat down with his disciples. Now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand. Now it's important that you kind of understand the physical context, the geographic context, but also the emotive context of this of what's happening here. Because actually both of them point to both a spiritual and a physical reality that I think are really important for us. And so the Sea of Tiberias, Jericho, that area of the world, all of that is some of the lowest points of altitude on the entire earth. And so this is a significantly physically low point. In fact, you're seeing somewhat of a discrepancy in the text because it starts at this low point and then Jesus goes up on this mountain with his disciples. And the way that I hope you've been taught to read the scriptures is that oftentimes when Jesus is presented being on a mountain or something happens in the scriptures on a mountain, something about the nature and the power of God is being revealed. In fact, if we were to read a little bit farther into the Gospels, there's this moment called the Transfiguration that happens on a mountain where they see the presence and power of Jesus between Moses and Elijah and presenting this picture of Jesus as the fulfillment of the law and the fulfillment of the prophets. That's all happening in that moment. It's actually a really powerful scene, and this happens on the mountain. It's the Mount of Olives that Jesus takes his disciples to, and when he's getting ready to resurrect and he reveals to them what they're supposed to, it's the Mount of Olives that allows them to see him in his glory as he's getting ready to resurrect. Like, those high places are meant to be exalted places of revelation, and we know that the valley is the opposite. Even if you kind of want to categorize your own life and people ask you how you're doing, you might say sometimes you're on the mountaintop and sometimes you're down in the valley. And that's not just like you got a timeshare up high and a timeshare down low and you're trying to switch up the season. To be in the valley means that you're going through difficult things, that you are in a low, difficult place. But it's not just that they're physically in a low geographic area, but it's also pointing to, even the way the text starts after this Jesus, points to this reality of an emotive low place. Because what happens previously is that John the Baptist, who is the cousin of Jesus, has just been beheaded. Matthew chapter 14 is helpful. Matthew 14 verses 10 through 13 would say it this way. He sent, and he being Herod, sent and had John beheaded in the prison. And his head was brought on a platter and given to the girl, and she brought it to her mother. And so the reality of what was happening is that John had gone to Herod and had seen that Herod was trying to have a relationship with his brother's wife, called him out on his sin, called him into repentance. She gets angry and she wants him dead. Her daughter goes in, begins to entertain, maybe better said seduce, Herod. Herod's like, I'll give you whatever you want. She wants John the Baptist's head. He cuts it off. And his disciples came and took the body and buried it and then went and told Jesus. Now when Jesus heard this, he withdrew from there in a boat to a desolate place by himself. That's the before that this is referring to, and when it says after this. And so now it's not just this geographical low place that's something like 690 feet below sea level. It's now, it's not just this kind of theological idea of the difference between the high place and the low place. It's also this emotive reality that Jesus has just lost the forerunner of his ministry. He's lost the one that was supposed to be preparing the way for him. He's lost the one that was the voice crying out in the wilderness when there hadn't been a voice for over 400 years amongst the people of God. Like, this is an important moment of loss that Jesus is experiencing. And I love that the scriptures slow down and show us the emotive response to Jesus, that he's not just like, hey, in my glory, John's going to be up there with me, but that he feels the loss in that moment. And the text would tell us that they're in a desolate place, a broken place, an empty place, a dry place, a place that isn't meant to feed their hearts, their souls, and what they're enduring, that they are in this place. And when they're trying to recover and deal with the loss and the reality, a crowd of people who have heard what he's been doing come running to receive more from Jesus. And then it's not accidental that verse 4 would tell you, now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand. And so for us, we kind of file that in our mind. Passover is a Jewish feast that refers to what happened in Exodus. But think about the reality of what happened at the first Passover. At the first Passover, the people of God were enslaved to Egypt, and the Lord had been showing his power, that there was no power in Egypt at all, that all the things that Egypt worshipped in its economy and its military strength were being shown to be nothing compared to the God of the Israelites. And then the last plague that he sends out is this idea that if there is not the blood of the lamb on a doorpost, that the house would not be passed over. And so year after year, the Jewish year started with the celebration of this moment to remind themselves of the faithfulness of God to provide for what they needed. And so think about the juxtaposition of what's happening in this broken, arid, dry, desolate place that seems to not be feeding their souls. People have come together to hear Jesus and see Jesus do work that reminds them of the faithfulness of God in the middle of something that doesn't look like the faithfulness of God. We got some tension up in this text. That's me. That's not the Bible. And then verse 5 would say this. Lifting up his eyes then, and seeing that a large crowd was coming toward him, Jesus said to Philip, "Where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat?" He said this to test him, for he himself knew what he would do. Philip answered him, 200 denarii worth of bread would not be enough for each of them to get a little. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "There is a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what are they for so many?" Now, I think it's important we know how the story ends. I would assume most of us know how the story ends. If you don't, that may mean that you're fairly new to the Bible, and I love that you're here, and thank you for taking the journey with us. But Jesus, knowing what he's doing, he asks Philip a question, and I just love the reality of Philip's response. Philip's like, here's the deal. Don't be distracted by the denomination of money. I'll just tell you what it is. 200 days' wages isn't enough to feed all these people. Like, we don't got enough to make this happen. Our treasurer, Judas, is a crook. We definitely don't have enough to make this happen. And then you've got Andrew, who's like, hey, there's this kid over here who's got 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. And so now you've got this weird juxtaposition. And it actually kind of reminds me of life. You kind of always have these different sets of people in your life. You're facing a tension, a challenge, something that the reality of your moment doesn't match the thing that you're hoping for, the thing that you should be celebrating. And then you've got that person that's just negative Nelson. That you're like, you got a small problem and they want to act like the world's about to fall apart. You're like, hey man, I think we're a little bit low on gas. Can we make it to the next gas station? Probably not. You got AAA? Like, I think we're going to be all right. I can see an Arco right there. And then you've got the other person in your life or the other set of friends in your life that it seems like they've always got a hookup, but you're not sure the hookup's legal. Because didn't nobody ask Andrew anything? There was a conversation between Jesus and Philip. Andrew's like, I found a kid over here who's got a sack lunch. Like, are we about to rob a little kid? Like, what's going on? But I think there are moments where we're going to face a challenge. And there are going to be voices around us, and neither one of them are actually going to be speaking what the Lord wants to do. But we have to be able to discern that. In fact, if you were to read this in Mark's gospel, Mark 6:35 would say this, "And when it grew late, his disciples came to him and said, 'This is a desolate place, and the hour is now late. Send them away to go into the surrounding countryside and villages and buy themselves something to eat.' But he answered them, 'You give them something to eat.' And they said to him, 'Shall we go and buy 200 denarii worth of bread and give it to them to eat?'" Like, they're like, "How are we going to do this? Like, what are you expecting of us? You're the one that's the living Son of God. Like, if you don't know how we're going to do this, how are we going to do this?" And then another interesting thing is the level of detail that John chooses to give us in this text. I don't know when you grew up, but I grew up in the 80s and the 90s. And so when I was in children's church, we had a thing called a flannel graph. If you don't know what a flannel graph is, it was a board with a blanket on it. And you had little pictures that you could stick onto the board to tell the story. And so it was always annoying if somebody had to travel in the story, because then your teacher would like, "Rip it off, put it on, rip it off, put it on." But when you heard this story of the feeding of the 5,000 with the flannel graph, here's what the story looked like. Two nice long loaves of French bread and these mini whales that were fish that this kid happened to be carrying around. That's not actually what the bread and the loaves are. In fact, the detail of having five barley loaves, the reason that that's important is because in that day and age, to have a barley loaf was food that was either suitable for animals or extremely poor people. You didn't eat barley loaves because it was flavorful. It wasn't. You weren't going to the nicest places in Jerusalem to go find some barley loaves. It was actually meager food for meager people who didn't have the wherewithal and the wealth within themselves to go get what they needed. And then the idea of this fish, many theologians think that it wasn't just these two full bodies of fish, but it was actually rather a relish that you were putting on top of your small piece of barley loaf. And so it was not this full, luxurious meal. It was actually the means for the poor to have a little bit of sustenance that day. And so for Andrew to be like, "Hey, there's a kid over here who's got poor people's food, and we got a challenge." In fact, I read it this way. The challenge of feeding the crowd is clearly impossible to satisfy through natural resources. The question actually is less about, can you conjure up the 200 denarii plus, or is the loaves and the fish sufficient? The question is, can Jesus be trusted when it feels like the odds are insurmountable? Because to trust Jesus when you don't need Jesus to do something impossible actually doesn't take that much courage. I don't have to have deep, embedded faith to believe that the Lord is going to make the engine of my car turn over this evening after we leave. I didn't take any courage for that, because my natural resources can do that. But there's something happening in this text. The tension's building between the context, between the resources they have, between the tension of what people are feeling. And so I don't know if any of other of you are preachers in the room, but the greatest challenge of preaching is lunchtime. When people are hungry, they are done. If the Spirit ain't done his work by the time that steak is ready, y'all are walking out on me. And so there's this real challenge of people's natural hunger with no natural resource to fill it. And what little they can find is this small lunch from this kid. What do they do with it? Verse 9 says, "There is a boy here who has five barley loaves and two fish, but where are they for so many?" And Jesus said, "Have the people sit down." Now there was much grass in the place, so the men sat down, about 5,000 in number. When Jesus took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated, and so also the fish, as much as they wanted. Now, here's what's interesting. Jesus is the hero of every story in the scriptures. He gets top billing. I think it's Francis Chan that uses the analogy of your life is like being the character in a movie who is there for 1 second and you don't even get named in the credits. Like, you are clearly not the hero. Well, Jesus is the opposite. He is the one that is on the poster that people come to see in the movie. So Jesus is the hero. I don't want to miss that. But every now and then, the hero chooses a sidekick. And what's interesting is, if what's being said about the bread and the fish is true, that this is the poor, meager means of a small child, then the person that he chooses to work alongside is not the type of person that you would often look to say that they're the person that I want to be like. I dare you, if you have the money in your bank account, to get a ticket and get whatever you need to do with a passport or a visa and go over to Jerusalem and look around and see if you can find where this small boy grew up. You can't. I'm not going to flip this and be like, and as we started doing the research on the text, this little boy grew up to be the Apostle Paul. Like, we don't know his name. We don't know anything else about him. We know that he had a sack lunch. And the text doesn't tell us, but I imagine that they didn't just hijack this barley loaves and this fish from him. I imagine that he gave it to him. And think about the level of courage that it would take to know that what you have is not enough for what's in front of you, but to say, but I'm going to give it to you and trust you with it, Jesus, anyways. Like think about the reality of, I know that I don't have what's needed to fix this problem. I don't even actually have enough for myself. That little 5 barley loaves and that little relish of fish was the means of the poor. So he wasn't getting strong and healthy and big off of that. It was just enough to kind of survive for that moment. And the reality of what the gospel often presses upon us is that we don't have enough for ourselves, much less for everybody else around us. And somehow yet Jesus can take that and do something with it. And the courage in that moment for Jesus to say, is this what we got? All right, sit them down in groups of 50. We're about to do this thing. Like, you got to be slightly insane to be like, all right, let's start passing the food. And yet the text says that they gave as much as everyone wanted. So like nobody was at the end of it like, Jesus was really cheap on the rations. I could have got a little bit more. I could have got seconds. Somehow there ended up being as much as people wanted. And Jesus is the one that is making this happen. And yet somehow this small boy ends up participating with Jesus and the thing that he wants to accomplish. And then in addition to that, it somehow stirs these disciples. Like, can you imagine how crazy it is that the disciples are standing next to Jesus saying, hey, we can't do this. How are we going to figure this out? And this little boy is like, well, I got more faith than they got. Here, you can have it, Jesus. And his act of courageous faith stirs them to enter in the work of Jesus. So let's have a new definition of courage. Courage is not that you're the superhero that stands against the storm. Courage is not that you are somehow willing to fight and claw and stand up and push back. Maybe courage is more simple than that. Maybe courage is just participating in what Jesus is doing, even when you're unsure of the results. Over the last few weeks, you've been talking about what it looks like as men to lead your homes, lead your families, lead your workplaces. And so sometimes courage is leading that Bible study even if you don't think anybody's listening. Sometimes courage is doing that devotional with your little ones. I got a 7-year-old and a 4-year-old. And sometimes I'm doing devotions with them and it's like, oh man, the Lord's moving right now. And sometimes I'm like, is he licking the wall? And courage is participating with Jesus on what he's doing, even if you're unsure of what the results are going to be. Then verse 11 would say this. Jesus then took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated, so also the fish as much as they wanted. And when they had eaten their fill, he told his disciples, gather up the leftover fragments that nothing may be lost. And so they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with fragments from the 5 barley loaves left by those who had eaten. When the people saw the sign that he had done, they said, this is indeed the prophet who is to come into the world. Perceiving that they were about to come and take him by force so to make him king, Jesus withdrew again to the mountain by himself. And one of the things I want you to see is just the pattern of the way that Jesus operates in the book of John. That Jesus takes what seems to be lacking and brings a life to it in such a way that there is more than enough. So that doesn't just happen in this text. It actually happens in John chapter 2, where Jesus shows up at a wedding with his mom. And in the midst of the wedding, they find out that they don't have enough wine. And they realize what's going on. Mary hears about it, and she says, Jesus can fix this. And he says, this is not my time yet. And in classic mother fashion, she's like, look, boy, I don't care what you're saying. They're going to go fill up the water jars. You're going to do this. And then when the master of ceremonies shows up and tastes the wine, he's like, this is the good stuff. Usually people start with the good stuff and it tapers off as people get more and more drunk, but you save the best for last. And that wasn't just a miracle that was meant to draw people's attention to Jesus' ability to make sure that the party keeps going. What the text would actually say in John 2 is that, that when Jesus did this, that God was glorified and disciples were made. That somehow what seemed to be in lack, Jesus has this ability to bring life to it in such a way that it has more abundance than it should. This is the story of John chapter 4, where you see a woman who is at a well in the middle of the day at the wrong time because she has lived a life that oftentimes the way that we want to couch it is that she has been sexually promiscuous. But women in that day and age didn't just go from man to man to man to man because they wanted to. There was tragedy after tragedy after tragedy that led to leading life in that way. But she's trying to avoid people and she's trying to have conversations about the right place to worship and who actually knows who God is. And then Jesus reveals himself to her in a way that he has not said to anybody to that point in the text. And now this woman goes from being an outcast who should not be part of her society to running in and bringing the town to come and know the favor of Jesus. That from this one woman that seemed like she was not enough with all of her issues and brokenness, all of a sudden Jesus is changing the destiny of this area of Samaria. We see it in John chapter 6. It's no wonder that Jesus shows up in John chapter 10 and says, hey, here's what I've been doing for the previous 9 chapters, that the thief has come to kill and steal and destroy, but I come that you might have life, and not just meager life, not just poor barley and loaves life, but have life all the way to its fullness. And so it's remarkable to me that he has shown over and over again the fullness that he provides, spiritually and otherwise. These people are literally have their bellies full and they still are not fulfilled at all. That they're still unsatisfied. Here's how I know that, because if you were to continue to read the text, you keep going into John chapter 6 and they follow Jesus even farther and they're like, hey man, you got any more of that bread that you just gave us? And I'm like, first of all, do you guys not have homes and jobs? Like, do you not know how to pack your lunch? And Jesus says to them, wait. Are you just following me around for the bread? And they're like, well, when Moses showed up, he had bread. And he says, well, if you really want bread, I'm the bread of life. And how we've couched that is this kind of this beautiful I am statement of Jesus, that he is the fresh aroma of God's provision for us. But what he's actually doing is rebuking them, saying that you're running around trying to make your belly full when I'm actually the thing that's supposed to fulfill you. And let's not lose the historical context. They're sitting, waiting for this Passover feast, this moment when they're supposed to be celebrating that God, through his presence and his power, has provided for them in a way that they could not provide for themselves. And somehow they know that, and yet they don't know that. Somehow they feel like they're physically full and yet unsatisfied in this moment when Jesus has shown the goodness of who he is. And now they're trying to drag him off and go make him a ceremonial king. And he's like, you're missing the whole picture. The setting and the miraculous provision are obvious indicators of the identity and power of Jesus. However, the crowd is more satisfied with being full for a moment instead of recognizing the eternal fulfillment Jesus brings. They don't know how to play the long game. And maybe one of the most courageous things we can do is not just be satisfied with what Jesus can do for us in a moment, but look for the deeper fulfillment that only the power of what he accomplished on the cross can bring. So what do we do with that? I said, the thought that I want to frame our time together is that our faith in Jesus gives us eyes to see opportunities amid challenging obstacles. Therefore, the people of God respond to chaos with courage. Maybe the way that I want to leave you and help you walk away from our time together is with two ideas. Here's the first. Courageous faith is challenging, costly, and contagious. You should be worried if a preacher ever says, hey, here's one of my ending points, and there's three subpoints in the ending point. That means you're getting two sermons in one. So let's just talk about that reality. To have gospel-formed courage is challenging. To be one that says that I'm going to partner with Jesus in what he's doing, regardless of whether it seems like it's effective or not, regardless of whether I can predict the results or not, that is challenging. There are going to be people who love Jesus and are desperate to follow him who will disagree with what you believe that Jesus is inviting you into doing, and you have to face the challenge of being in disagreement with them. It's challenging because you have no guarantees. We only have so many years, and we don't even know how many we have. And so it doesn't feel like we've got moments or opportunities to waste. And so to enter in with Jesus and say, okay, I think that you're doing this. I think that you're calling me to this, but I don't know if it's going to turn out the way that I want it to. That's a level of courage that should make us feel a little bit unsettled. It is challenging to follow Jesus into the things that he's doing when there are no guarantees for what we're stepping into. And it's costly. Like, can you think about being this boy that if I'm the, see, don't let me be in the Bible. Because if I were in the scriptures and Andrew was like, hey, there's a dude named Mike over here who's got five barley loaves. Oh, he had five barley loaves. He ate them. Sorry, guys. Never mind. Because I'm stuffing that stuff in my mouth. I'm not sharing with anybody. I'm like, that's on y'all for not packing your lunch. And so this kid, this is all that he has. He's not running home and saying, oh, I got enough for everybody. And he's willing to give what little he has that Jesus might do what only Jesus can do. Not that Jesus was in need of what he had, but the courage to participate in what Jesus was doing. It will cost you something. It will cost you reputation. It will cost you comfort. It may cost you opportunity. I had a conversation with a lady recently. She and her husband have struggled to have children. And the church that he's on staff at, they were getting ready to do a capital campaign for their children's facility. And they were saving up money to adopt a child. And as they were getting ready, they felt the Lord's press that because we're on staff, we need to help lead our congregation in generosity in this way. And so she felt the Lord saying to her, the money that you guys have saved up, you need to give that to the building of this children's wing. They don't have kids. And the money that they would have to have kids, they're giving away. So a part of the church building that they don't even effectively use, they're giving what belongs to them to that. And the courage to obey Jesus in what doesn't make sense in most of our minds. It's costly, but as challenging as it is, and as costly as it is contagious. Have you ever been around somebody that's just got a gift of faith? That just, I'll just confess to you, in the New Testament where it talks about the spiritual gifts, one of the lists talks about the gift of faith. And I didn't know that was a thing. I mean, I knew it was a thing, right? Like, I knew it was in the scriptures, like I read it. But when I would be around people, including myself, that would operate in a gift of faith at times, I'd be like, no, that person is just crazy. But that the Spirit would bore in people's hearts this courageous belief that Jesus is able to accomplish much with what very little that we have. When you're around somebody that's that way, doesn't it kind of stir something in you? In fact, I don't think the secular world has language for this. And so one of my favorite authors is a man named Malcolm Gladwell. And Malcolm Gladwell uses this analogy of thresholds. And what he talks about is that there's this thing that you have to watch somebody else do a thing and then you'll do it. And so this happens all the time in marketing. So back in 2007, when the very first iPhone came out, there were certain people, like my roommate, his name was Gabe Smith. My roommate Gabe, he was the seventh person in line in Plano, Texas to get an iPhone. I sat in line at some point with him and I didn't even get a phone. He was like, I've got to get this thing. It's going to be awesome. I wasn't an early adopter. I was kind of part of the early majority. I was like the second group of people who were like, oh yeah, like Gabe seems like he's okay. Nothing blew up when he called somebody. I'm going to get one. And then there's the kind of late majority. It was like, well, now everybody's got one, so I guess I have to get one. And then there are the laggards, is what they call it in marketing. This is your grandma who, like last year, her cell phone company were like, look, ma'am, we can no longer service your Nokia 5180. You're going to have to get a smartphone. And there is this reality that oftentimes people don't step forward in faith until they see courageous faith in someone else. In fact, I think that's part of why the Lord has not made us these isolated units, but has invited us into community, because we spur one another towards good works. There's something about your courage and my courage that spurs us forward. And so as challenging and costly as it is also this beautiful, contagious thing that when we say, Jesus, I trust you enough, even though I don't understand the results, to participate with you, others say, I'll be a part of it also. It wasn't the little boy that passed out the food. It was the disciples, and they didn't believe before he was willing to sacrifice. And then I'll leave it here. Participating with Jesus in his work to renew the world is not a momentary endeavor. It's a lifelong pursuit. With what little time I have left, I just want to share a little bit of my story. And so Brian mentioned me being in Dallas for 10 years before being here for 8 years. But I actually grew up in Oklahoma City. My parents moved there from Ghana, West Africa. I was born there. If you want to know why I'm a Lakers fan, I was born in the 80s. My parents lived in Worcester before they lived in Oklahoma. So they were Celtics fans. And so just to make my mom mad, I became a Lakers fan. And we began going to a church when I was in middle school called Crossroads. I, like most 13-year-old boys, wanted to be doing anything else on Sunday mornings. And so my 13-year-old master plan was, the church had a video department. I'm going to start filming the services so that way I didn't have to pay attention. Needless to say, I was not a very smart 13-year-old. And so I began to get plugged in and serving at the church, and that went from serving in the video department to being a youth leader to I get into college and I'm going to the University of Oklahoma, and here's my master plan. Lord, I don't think you're calling me to ministry, even though I've had people in my life tell me that you're calling me to ministry. I am going to get my marketing degree, get my law degree. I'm going to become a sports agent, live in a high-rise in New York City, and make lots of money, and I'll give some percentage of that back to the church. My junior year, the Lord interrupts that and says, that's not what I'm calling you to at all. Blows up my plan, and all of a sudden I end up getting hired at that church that I did not want to participate in except for being in the video department, because I was this genius 13-year-old who wasn't that smart at all. On staff there, it circumvented my plan. At the time, I was not just going to school, but I was also an intern at the Tinker Federal Credit Union, which is the largest credit union in Oklahoma City. I was getting ready to move into the marketing department, and the trajectory was for me to continue to grow there, eventually become the VP of marketing until I finished law school and went off and did my thing. So I laid that down. End up working at the church as the children's pastor and the young adult pastor, which I'm sure those kids that were in my children's ministry need lots of counseling today, but that's neither here nor there. And so during that season, a man named Brian Jarrett, who was a pastor in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, became a mentor of mine. And he was visiting Oklahoma City preaching at another church in the summer of 2006. And so I drove over to that church. I'm sitting in service, sitting next to a buddy of mine named Travis, and he's preaching out of Luke 7 about the woman who takes the perfume and breaks it and cries on Jesus' feet. I'm telling that story and the cost of surrendering to Jesus. And as I'm hearing him preach, I feel like the Spirit of God is saying, I'm asking you for more. I'm asking you to live that way. And I'm like, Lord, why are you letting me hear your conversation with Travis? That's awkward. And it became so uncomfortable for me that I got up and went to the restroom. And one of my buddies who attended that church, his name was Kyle, he walks up to me, he's like, man, isn't it awesome what God's doing? And I'm wrestling with this thing, and I'm like, no, it's not, leave me alone. And the guy who was preaching, Brian, like I said, he was a mentor of mine, and usually if he was in town, I would go to dinner with him, and I was so disturbed by what I felt like the Lord was challenging me with. I didn't even stay to talk to him or go to dinner. I go home, I'm frustrated, I can't sleep. And so I get up and I drive to the church and I'm like, I'm going to go pray. And so this is one of those, like, I don't know what your relationship with the Lord is with the Lord. I got two journals. I got the journal that if somebody breaks into my office and reads it, they'd be like, I'm proud that he's my pastor. And then I got the journal that if they found it, they'd be like, oof. So this was one of those prayers. And I was like, Lord, do you realize what I gave up? Do you realize what I gave up financially? Do you realize what I gave up in notoriety? Do you realize that the way, what it cost me being in ministry, I was single at the time, and one of the policies at the church was that you couldn't date somebody that was at the church. And so I was like, so how am I ever going to get married because I worked 97,000 hours a week? Like feeling all of that press. I'm like, Lord, here's what I have. I have my family being near me, and I have this job. You want me to give that up too? Which I would suggest that if you're going to rant at the Lord, you should not give him suggestions while you do that. Because it felt like the answer was yes. And so at this point, I don't know what to do. And so I decide, hey, I'm just going to go down to Dallas. At that point, Brian had moved from Pine Bluff, Arkansas to Dallas. I'm going to drive to Dallas. I'm just going to have a conversation with Brian. So I drive to Pine Bluff, Arkansas. I drive to Dallas. I ask him, hey, here's what I'm feeling. What should I do? And he's like, I have no idea what the Lord wants you to do with your life. But you should spend some time with him and figure it out. So I spent the rest of that summer and into the fall trying to figure it out. And it just so happened in the fall, he was coming to preach at our church. And as he was preaching at our church, he began to tell the story of the feeding of the 5,000. And as he told that story, there's a particular phrase that Luke uses that reshaped my life. Here's what it says in Luke 9:14, the latter half into 15. And he, being Jesus, said to the disciples, have them sit down in groups of about 50 each. And here's the part that changed my life, these four little words. And they did so. This is going to sound a little bit more morbid, but I think about my death. And I think about when somebody walks through the graveyard and looks at my tombstone. I want those four words on my tombstone. And he did so. That he had the courage to be obedient to the thing that Jesus was calling him into. So in that season of my life, that when I heard Brian say that, I was like, okay, I need to go, and I don't know where to go, and so I'm just gonna, hey, can I come serve you? And so I finished my year at that church, and then I moved down to Dallas, Texas, and I began to live in an old recovery house it was me, my roommate Gabe, who was one of the first iPhone people, and the former pastor's son, who was just hanging out there until he got married. They didn't have a job for me, and so I was working at the mall selling jeans, and then they were paying me $75 a week to edit video because they heard about my history editing video, edit video for the Spanish ministry for their TV program. Here's the problem with that. I don't speak Spanish. There might be a lot of heresy out there that I edited. I have no idea. And it was this season of surrender and humility and giving things up. And the Lord did some amazing things. And I served at that church for 7 years. But then in October of 2013, the Lord began to stir my heart. Hey, I need you to lay some things down again. I want you to consider being a church planter in a part of the world that is not near your family and not near people that you've known. And it felt like the Lord was asking me to lay down the reputation that I'd built and the favor and the comfort. And I'd been married for about a year at that time. I'm like, now I'm going to drag my wife to somewhere where we don't know anybody. And what I want my life to be said of is that, and he did so. And just recently, I feel like the Lord has been doing this thing in my heart where every time I read the scriptures, he's reminding me of humility and hiddenness and obscurity and death. And I feel like he's leading me into this, and he did so season again of my life where it's like, okay, you're going to ask me to lay something down again, and it's going to be hard, and I don't know what it's going to be. But what the reason that I'm telling you this much of my story is not because I want this to be about my story, but I want it to be about the reality that it was not just a moment back in 2006. 1996, and it wasn't just a moment in 2013. It won't just be a moment whenever this next one comes, but for the rest of my days, I will deal with this question of courage, that the Lord is doing something, and I have very little to offer, but will I have the courage to participate with him, even if I don't know what the results are going to be? And I think the question is true of you also. So here's what I want to do. I want to pray for you. And we're gonna worship together. We're going to cast our eyes on the hero of the story. And then after that, we're going to have an opportunity to go sit and talk through, man, how is the Lord redefining courage? We're going to talk through, man, what does it look like to really participate with what Jesus is doing in this season? And it may not be you being Steve Rogers and tightening the strap on your arm and going into battle. It might be you doing something that's humble and insignificant that nobody will ever know your name about. But what does it look like for us to live out this type of gospel courage? Let me pray. And so, Jesus, I long for me, I long for the men of Lighthouse to be able to say that at the end of our lives, you could look at us and say, and they did so. That you called us to participate with you as you take what seems to be full of lack and brokenness and entering into desolate places and bringing life into them. But Lord, protect us, because what often happens with us is that we want the momentary fulfillment of seeing you do the thing, and we can often miss you in the midst of it. And so help us to see you, and help us to see that you are the humble king that Philippians talks about, that your exaltation came through your humiliation. And so oftentimes that's the path that we follow with you also. Help us to be courageous in partnering with you in that. Help us to be men that said of us, and they did so. It's in your matchless name I pray. Amen. Amen.